I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. First, the good news from Rio. The American gymnastics team and its star Simone Biles continue to wow audiences and win gold medals. Swimmer Michael Phelps has added to his gold medal collection. And who isn't moved and inspired by the team of refugees competing at the Olympic Games? But this elite sporting event has been taking place under the shadow of doping. The World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, recommended that all Russian athletes be barred from the Olympics for past cheating. The International Olympic Committee rejected that blanket ban except for the Russians competing in the Paralympics. Today on Radio Times, performance-enhancing drugs and the Olympics, how prevalent is it? Do these drugs improve performance? Why do athletes use these banned substances and how do they stay ahead of the testers? And we have three guests who have joined us, including Dennis Cardone, Chief of Primary Care Sports Medicine at the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at NYU Langone Medical Center. And Dennis Cardone, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Mark Johnson. He's a journalist, author of a new book called Spitting in the Soup, Inside the Dirty Game of Doping in Sport. Mark Johnson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. And here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Eugen Diemant, and he's a lecturer, behavioral researcher at the University of Pennsylvania in the Department of Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. He focuses on immoral and criminal behavior. And Eugen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
Dennis, let me begin with you. Is there any way to know how many elite athletes, especially in Rio, are taking performance-enhancing drugs?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's certainly difficult to have an exact number, right, because they're certainly not volunteering the information. But, you know, certainly it's more than we would typically think, right? Athletes, elite athletes especially, are trying to get any edge that they can. So while we don't know a number, rest assured there are certainly athletes that are using performance-enhancing drugs.
I'm not sure where all that noise is coming in, but we will carry on here. Let me go to you, back to you, Dennis. You work with elite athletes. Just how often are you asked by some of these athletes for something to help their performance?
It is common. Again, they're looking for any edge that they could have. So very commonly, they will, you know, they'll ask, but they're very educated about what's out there, you know, because it's been around. It's been around for years and in all their training, and it certainly has come up, certainly in the gyms where they're at. So they're very well educated about it. So even if they're not asking about it, rest assured they know a lot about it. So they're always looking for that edge. And in most cases, you know, sport is clean. No doubt about it, and most, you know, in general, and really what they're asking about when they speak to me in the office is more about, is there any supplement that's not on the banned list that can help improve in performance?
And what's the popular request you're getting?
Yeah, usually it is about the over-the-counter supplements, right? There's a billion-dollar industry, and it's mostly about protein supplements. I mean, that's the big thing right now, protein supplements, another supplement called creatine, for example. Those are the big questions and the main users that people are using, that these elite athletes are using.
Mark, let me get you in on the conversation. Again, you wrote a book called Spitting in the Soup. First of all, what does your title refer to?
Well, it refers to a cycling term. So pro cyclists, when someone in the pro cycling peloton would say, well, I'm going to come clean and talk about how dirty this sport is, the phrase was a French phrase, say, well, why would you spit in the soup? Why would you ruin the broth that supports all of us by coming clean about how dependent we are on drugs?
But should we look at these Olympics taking place in Rio and question some of the performances, some of the fact that world records are being broken? Should we have that level of suspicion, Mark?
Well, I think you should always be suspicious. But really what I look at in my book is the fact that performance-enhancing drugs have been part of elite sports since really elite and professional sports got their start in the Industrial Revolution. And it really wasn't until the 1960s that an anti-doping bureaucracy took place and our attitudes towards doping soured. And what was previously seen as just a technological tool all of a sudden became a cancer on sport that was corrupting something. And really for roughly the first 100 years of pro sports, it wasn't seen as a corruptive influence, as a relatively new phenomenon.
And what if the 60s is when this happened, was there an incident that changed people's perspective?
Well, there was a couple incidents. One was a Danish athlete died at the 1960 Rome Olympics in the cycling team time trial. Although his death was attributed to heat stroke, it was accused in the press of being related to amphetamines, even though amphetamines weren't present in the autopsy. And that sort of started to generate concern amongst the European medical community about the health risks of doping. And then at the same time in the 60s, there was a greater social concern about really the anxieties of recreational drug use, and it sort of compounded into a anti-doping bureaucracy.
I want to get back to both of the things that you both said, but let me get you, Eugen, in on the conversation. Why you have looked at this? What are the kind of pressures that athletes feel to take some of these banned substances?
Well, so the pressures are, there are many aspects to this. And from like an individual perspective, athletes have this pressure of performing well, of winning prizes, of winning the competitions, a lot of reputational concerns. But there's also this collective aspect of representing the nation, of representing the culture, and you know, just showing that you are the best among others. So there are very different aspects to this.
And is it more true in a team sport versus, let's say, an individual athlete performing solo?
So there are different mechanisms at work. In an individual competition, you represent yourself first and foremost, but in Olympics, you represent a national team as well, so the country as well. In a team sport, you rely a lot on peer pressure among your peers as well. So you compete with yourself and against others, but also against sort of your team. As well. And so you push yourselves.
Let me go back to you, Dennis. And is it clear to athletes what is banned, what isn't banned, what is acceptable, what isn't acceptable?
It's certainly in this day and age, it should be very clear to the athletes. WADA, just like you said, the World Anti-Doping Agency, makes it very clear. They have a ban list that's updated every year. Certainly coaches and all of the Olympic committees at the national level are very aware. So it's something for sure that, you know, there's just in this day and age, there's no excuse that they weren't aware. Ignorance is absolutely not an excuse. You know, and even if we look at, for example, Maria Sharapova and that whole meldonium, what happened there, you know, there's just so much warning that WADA gives about these banned substances. So ignorance is not an excuse.
But are these lists, are they overly inclusive? I mean, are there too many things on the list that maybe actually are not performance-enhancing drugs?
No, the list, you know, it's a good list, and it's reviewed constantly and updated, like I said. And for athletes, I mean, the only reason why they should be taking any of those substances is for certain medical conditions. And if they do have a condition that needs to be treated by one of these banned substances, there's something called a therapeutic use exemption. So there is a way to go through the proper channels if they do, in fact, for medical reason, need to use one of these substances. But otherwise, there is just no reason why they should be using them.
And what about ADHD? I'm thinking about just how common it is for regular people and perhaps even athletes to get a prescription for ADHD.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's a great example, ADHD, and one of the treatments or the number one treatment for it is a stimulant, an amphetamine. So, you know, with that said, ADHD is certainly a significant problem for people, and it does need to be treated. So here's where you have to go through the proper channels. So with the proper therapeutic exemption, going through filling out the proper paperwork, having the proper physician sign off on it with the diagnoses, that is something that absolutely can be, you know, where there could be this exemption to take that medication, and it would not be a problem.
Mark, let me go back to you, and what do you think of this, of the list of banned substances, especially for the Olympics?
Well, certainly within the academic community, in terms of the doping historians, there is arguments that's been made that anti-doping should focus on the drugs that are truly harmful. There isn't a lot of evidence that marijuana is a performance-enhancing drug. In fact, you could argue that it's a performance-degrading drug, but it's still banned. And one of the criticisms of this massive list of drugs is that it's more of a moral hygiene project than something that is focused on protecting athlete health, because steroids are much more damaging for an athlete than marijuana, yet they're both banned.
What do you mean by moral hygiene?
Well, really, the anti-doping project, when you look at the history of anti-doping, is an extension of what used to be the Olympic project, which was to keep the Olympics an amateur-only game. And, in fact, the first IOC anti-doping rules that were written in 1947 were a subset of rules about how to maintain your amateurism. And it wasn't so much that doping was harmful to the athlete's health, but it was evidence that the athlete was using professional sporting practices.
So this sort of migration from an amateur event to a more professional event. Dennis, just picking up on what Mark said about marijuana, is marijuana on that list, and is it considered a performance-enhancing drug?
Well, you know, so exactly, marijuana is on the list. And I guess, you know, you could make the argument, just like, for example, with beta blockers, a certain group of medications also that people use for high blood pressure, that maybe for certain sports it is performance enhancing. For example, like a sport where you just have to have very steady hands, like shooting, for example. So you can, if it is relaxing and it relaxes the athlete, you can make the argument that for certain types of sports and performance that it can enhance, that it can be an enhancer. Absolutely.
Well, I know some musicians talk about taking beta blockers for that very reason, Dennis.
Yes, no, exactly right. And that's why, though these are not maybe harmful, and in your typical sport that you would think about performance enhancement, it would be more your atypical sports where just being more relaxed, again, would provide a performance boost.
I know we have to say goodbye to you in about a minute then. I mean, are we talking about a cat and mouse game when it comes to athletes taking some of these banned substances and the regulators trying to catch them? Dennis?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that's a great way to put it, right? And we always say that the athletes are always one step ahead of the regulatory commission. So, you know, they're always looking for ways, if for no better word, to cheat the system a little bit. So to not get caught, improve their performance, enhance their performance, and in general, they do stay ahead of the game. The regulatory commissions and WADA are really, really doing a great job and getting much, much better. And certainly they're doing more and more testing, and they're doing year-round testing. And there are other programs that they're starting to put in place to try to really clean up sports. So while athletes, we always think they're one step ahead of the game, you know, WADA and other organizations similar are really doing a nice job to perform this necessary regulation.
Dennis Cardone, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome.
To be here. Thank you.
Nice to have you with us. And again, Chief of Primary Care Sports Medicine at the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the NYU Langone Medical Center. We're just saying goodbye to him. Mark Johnson and Eugen Dement staying with us for the rest of the hour. Much more to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Earlier this week, American swimmer Lily King chided Russian competitor Ulia Efimova, who had previously been banned for drug use. King wagged her finger at Efimova and criticized her in an interview on NBC.
Well, Lily, we saw you in the ready room, and you watched Efimova, and she put up her number one, and you sort of went, what were the words that go with that gesture?
You know, you're shaking your finger number one, and you've been caught for drug cheating. I'm just not, you know, I'm not a fan, so... going to go swim my heart out for USA, and hopefully that turns out the best.
Well, yesterday, Lily King broke an Olympic record swimming the 100-meter breaststroke, won a gold medal, and beat Efimova, who won silver. We are continuing our conversation, talking with Mark Johnson. Wrote a book called Spitting in the Soup, Inside the Dirty Game of Doping in Sport. And Eugen Dement, again, a lecturer, behavioral researcher at the University of Pennsylvania in the Department of Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. And his work focuses on what's called immoral and criminal behavior. We want to hear hear from you if in any way some of these allegations and in some cases evidence of doping in past sporting events has raised some questions for you about watching the Rio Olympics. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Again, we heard Lily King essentially calling out this Russian swimmer. Some have stood up for her and said, yeah, she's, you know, calling out someone who had tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs in the past. I also read some people saying that's kind of bad sportsmanship on her side, which is just compete in the pool and, in a sense, keep your mouth shut.
Well, so it sends a horrible, horrible signal to let people compete who've been not only alleged to, you know, take performance-enhancing drugs, but have also been caught not once but twice, as it is the case for Yefimova. I believe it's the right signal to send and stand up and say, you know, it's not okay to compete in this field if it's not a level playing field for everyone.
And what do you think about that, Mark?
Well, I think that the IOC certainly missed the chance to send a message, because especially during the Cold War was really the greatest accelerator of doping technology that we've ever seen, because during the East, what the East Germans and the Russians, and to a lesser extent the United States, was doing was really trying to assert their geopolitical dominance and power on the Olympic stage. And so in East Germany, for instance, they were administering 2 million doses of steroids per year for their Olympic athletes.
Wow.
And I think if the IOC had sent a message, which it had done previously, for instance, with South Africa, it banned South Africa because of its apartheid policies, it could have said, look, if you continue to run a state-managed doping program, you are going to lose your position entirely on the Olympic stage, which is really the worst thing that could happen to a country that wants to assert itself by showing up and winning gold medals.
Is this a vestige of the Cold War, Mark?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They were really sort of regenerating the systems that were perfected during the Cold War, where, for instance, in East Germany, they had an anti-doping lab where before an East German athlete could leave the country, they had to test negative at this lab so that they wouldn't be caught outside the country. And really, the Russians were sort of using the same thing with their own lab to subvert anti-doping rules.
Does this tie to the allegations involving the Olympics at Sochi, Mark?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's where the Russians were using their own lab to ensure that the Russians were, even though they were doped, they were using the lab to ensure that they showed up as negative for doping products.
I know you want to add something to that, Eugen.
No, so So I'm German, so I can very much relate to this aspect of East Germany and the culture of doping. And I mean, in the case of Russia, Russia has a very deeply rooted culture of doping, and they're very proud. They take a lot of pride in past performance at, you know, past Olympic Games and stuff. So there's a lot of pressure on the individual athlete, and not only from, you know, it's not only the expectations of the nation itself, but the government puts a lot of pressure on these athletes, and they don't let them compete if they stand up and whistleblow, as this has been the case for Yulia Stepanova a couple of years ago.
I mean, it does raise questions, and I think, and I'll go back to you, Eugen, which is as someone viewing athletics, we're talking about the Olympics, viewing the Olympics. You hear about Michael Phelps, you know, perhaps the greatest athlete ever to perform in the Olympics. I think he's got 21 gold medals in his career at the Olympics. It does raise questions. Are we watching someone who has done something to enhance their performance?
Yeah, and so that's the general problem now with sports. Now, as all these different kinds of sports have been facing problems of doping, it becomes increasingly difficult for even the non-doping, you know, athletes to signal that they are clean and that sort of their performance is the result of hard work and merit. And so in this case, from like a sort of economic perspective, there's even a high incentive now to maybe engage in doping, because no one believes that you're clean anyway, and you would like to try to level the playing field by taking the substances you expect other athletes to take, which we call like a prisoner's dilemma, right? And so you expect other people to do that.
Prisoner's dilemma.
And so it's not about what other people or other athletes do. It's about what you expect other athletes to do. And if you think all of them or most of them that you're competing with are taking these substances, you do the same, although it's detrimental to yourself, but also to like the sports.
And I want to say that I in no way am I challenging Michael Phelps and what he has done to win all those gold medals. But Mark, it does, I mean, if we have perhaps, I don't know, naive, maybe childish views of some of these sporting events, it does raise questions about what it's to be a viewer and what it is to root for a team or to root for a particular athlete.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to make the assumption that an athlete at the elite Olympic and professional level is not turning to these substances that have always been part of professional sports. And really what anti-doping is trying to do is to impose a state of chemical and moral purity that's really antithetical to the history of high-performance sport, which isn't, we think it's playing fair, but it's really to enlist technology to push the boundaries of human performance. And drugs have always been part of that, but we're still, the anti-doping traumas that we see today are really part of this battle that's going on to impose a new state of purity, which I think is particularly difficult in America, where we have stated by advertising performance-enhancing drugs like Viagra, ADHD drugs, on television that is perfectly acceptable for society at large, but athletes are held up to a different set of standards. And so as a society, we're somewhat hypocritical in our expectations of athletes because we don't apply them to ourselves, at least in America.
So, Mark, are you suggesting that WADA, IOC, stop or take away this list of banned substances, banned drugs, and just let the games begin?
No, I don't believe that because I really don't think that America's own drug policy at large, which is fairly pragmatic and hands-off, is a good way to turning to pharmaceuticals to treat any pathology or aging isn't necessarily the best way to deal with those pathologies. So I think that if we were just to legalize drugs, particularly for the young athlete, the 18, 17-year-old kid, I don't think it's right to ask them to have to come up with the money and pay the doctors in order to dope to perform at the highest level. Yeah, so I don't think a free-for-all, high-octane sporting field is what we should go towards.
Well, we had a guest on the show last week who had spent time as a young man. He was actually a teenager as a bodybuilder. This was maybe 15 or 20 years ago, so obviously not present tense. But he took steroids. He got amazing results. But he also had serious side effects. I mean, from crushing headaches, acne, you know, when you're a teenager, it's not like you want even more acne than you already have, and other even psychological problems as well. So for the individual athlete to take some of these drugs is to risk their health.
Yes.
So, and do they know that?
Yeah. And they're willing to do that, right? Because and this is mainly attributed to the fact that the time window for a professional athlete is fairly narrow. So you have just these couple of years where you can perform well. And what we see in research is sort of like a U-shaped relationship between taking drugs or taking performance-enhancing drugs and age. If you're young, sort of taking these kind of drugs boosts your performance by a big margin. You know, you have
because
a lot of potential.
Young?
Yeah, and you have a lot of potential. There's a lot of, you know, potential to grow. And so this declines as you get a bit older, but then as you come closer towards the end of your career, now all the punishment that can be inflicted on you, like being banned from any kind of competition, really doesn't have as much impact on you anymore because you're so close to retiring anyway. So that's what we call sort of like the end game effect, right? So as you are close to retiring, you might be willing to use them even more just to keep that edge to perform well at the high age and then retire anyway.
Let me just throw out the name Lance Armstrong to you, Mark Johnson. I know that you have covered professional cycling and Lance Armstrong himself, who, of course, denied all these allegations, broke all these records. Turns out he was doping while he was competing in the Tour de France and other competitions. How much do you think he's sort of hurt athletes?
Well, I don't think that he's necessarily hurt athletes. I mean, if anything, the fact that the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency aggressively held him accountable shows that it is actually possible for an anti-doping agency to be independent. And mind you, the United States is really late to the anti-doping game. France banned drugs, made it a federal offense in 1965. We didn't even create an anti-doping agency until 2000. So we are really late to the game. But nonetheless, the fact that the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency held him accountable and stripped his 7 Tour de France's is pretty remarkable, particularly when you consider that over the last 30 years, the majority of the Tour de France winners have been implicated in doping scandals. And he's the only one that's really suffered for it, other than Floyd Landis and Alberto Contador.
Again, you want to add to that?
Yeah, so there's this indirect effect that is often overlooked, and it's this effect of imitation, or what we study as behavioral contagion. And I mean, the fact that these athletes who are superstars in a game, they take these drugs, they perform well, they have all these winnings, this leads to other people imitate this kind of behavior. And what we find really is that this kind of bad behavior spills over very, very quickly, right? So a bad example of somebody who's been cheating but got away for a long, long time and was able to, win a lot of prize money. This kind of example sort of leads to imitation of this kind of behavior.
What about when they get caught? I mean, does that then cast a kind of shadow on what people have been doing?
Yes, but I mean, Armstrong was amazing at hiding this for many, many years. There was always this assumption, always this suspicion he might be, but no one was ever able to really claim that. And in retrospect, it seems that he's been doing this all the time. But he has shown that you can perform extremely well using these drugs and not being caught over a long, long period of time. And what we know is people are, they're very sensitive to changes in the chance of being caught as opposed to increasing the punishment. So it's not really about just letting people, stay out of competition for more years that would distract people from engaging in drugs. But it's more about making them feel like there's a higher chance of being caught for that.
Interesting. Let me get some callers and some comments as we talk about the challenges of catching athletes who are doping using performance-enhancing drugs. And again, Mark Johnson and Eugen Demet are guests, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. I see a bunch of comments here. Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me see what Rick from Warminster has to say. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air. You got to turn your phone down. Let me read a Facebook comment from James. He says, when an MLB player is suspended for amphetamine use, for instance, Carlos Ruiz, is there any way to tell if the athletes took ADHD medicine or simply greenies? I'm not even exactly sure what that person is asking, but perhaps, Mark, you do.
Well, amphetamines have been part of the National Football League and baseball from – well, amphetamines were first made commercially available in 1937 as Benzedrine, and they were quickly adopted, particularly amongst football players, to a lesser extent by baseball players. But, I mean, baseball and football are very different in America because they have very strong unions, and aggressive anti-doping was seen as something that violated the workers' rights, the rights of the players. And so the anti-doping in baseball and football really didn't come into play, and wasn't until relatively recently that the union even allowed anti-doping testers to test players. So it's a very different situation to European sports like cycling, where anti-doping agencies took a much more aggressive, paternalistic approach to ridding the sport of doping. Whereas in baseball or football, if business is good, doping was a problem, was bad for sponsors, so just keep it under the rug.
You wrote in your book, Mark, about an early on event where an athlete was given strychnine and brandy. Tell us that story.
So that was in 1904 Olympics in St. Louis, Missouri. And Charles Lucas was a British-American runner, and he won the marathon. And his physician, who followed along with him, administered both strychnine which we tend to think of as rat poison,
yep.
but in small doses, it can be a stimulant, and brandy. And after the event, it was celebrated. His doctor, and he was also an Olympic chronicler, praised the use of drugs as something that was essential to that athlete's performance. And that really illustrated how attitudes towards doping in sport have changed dramatically over the last 100 years. Because at the beginning of professional sports, really 1870s, 1880s, it was seen as a trade school and not something that raised ethical problems. And that, Charles, that 1904 Olympics is a really great example of that.
Absolutely. And I mean, we know there's better training now. People have better diets. I mean, there's so many things, Mark, that athletes can do, their coaches can do to make them better performers. And we're seeing world records being broken left and right. Is this just sort of part of the evolution of elite sports?
It is part of the evolution of elite sport, which has always reached a technology to push boundaries of performance and win. Because the essence of professional sports is not fair play. It's making money, entertaining people, and winning. But the Olympics, because of the Olympics was founded on this myth of fair play, which is born of Pierre de Coubertin, who was a French aristocrat, who created the Olympics to create sort of this paradise for gentlemen athletes who didn't have to work. They were definitely not professionals. That sort of spirit of sport persists. It's incredibly durable, and that's why we continue this project to try and purify sport and return it to this Edenic state, which really never existed. Well, but we're still aspiring to it.
I mean, we're almost having a break here, Mark, but you're saying that sounds like a lost cause.
Well, now in 2013, the World Anti-Doping Agency issued a report and said that they're catching 2% of the cheats. And if they took out the people who are testing positive for asthma and marijuana, it would be less than 1%.
Wow. Well, let's take a short break. That's Mark Johnson, wrote a book called Spitting in the Soup, Inside the Dirty Game of Doping in Sport. Also with us is Eugen Diemant, a lecturer behavioral researcher at the University of Pennsylvania in the Department of Philosophy, Politics, and Economics, looking at why people break the rules, do criminal things, sometimes immoral things. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We've been talking about the prevalence of drug use among elite athletes, also some of the innovative methods that serious athletes are using to evade detection of doping, and also why athletes, and we're talking not just at high levels, but also perhaps even in high school and college, why they might want to use performance-enhancing drugs. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, again, we were talking during the break, and I said to you, so does punishment work? I mean, even serious punishment work. And some of these athletes have had to put their careers on hold because they were not allowed to perform. Does that have a kind of effect of sending a message to other athletes, you shouldn't do this?
Well, so punishment, having good punishment that really works and really sends a signal of, you know, we disagree with what you do, we disapprove of what you do, definitely sends the right signal. The problem is that research shows that people don't quite react to differences in punishment. As you increase the punishment, you don't see people reacting to that, and they're not as deterred by that as you would them expect. But what you see instead is if you increase sort of the likelihood of being punished, people have this perception of how likely it is for being, you know, mm-hmm. being punished for misbehavior. People react to this way more. They are way more sensitive to changes in the likelihood than their changes in the extent of punishment.
And what about a coach? I mean, let's say a coach is really tough on something like this. Does that message resonate? And there's certainly coaches that are the opposite of that, which perhaps looking the other way when people might be taking performance-enhancing drugs.
Well, I mean, so like, for example, for Russia, we see that all kinds of different levels of people were involved. It's not only the professional athletes, it's also the coaches, all different kind of people. And as an athlete, you follow sort of the lead, you follow the advice of your coach, and if your coach really imposes, a strict rule against that, this might help you to stay away from drugs. But if he wants you to compete at the highest level, if he wants you to win, and if he sort of helping you to maybe even get these substances, you're very likely to be inclined to do that. And
it's common for people to, if not lie to themselves, be in some degree of denial about what they might be doing.
Yeah, and I mean, so in order to be in a peace and you know being happy with yourself, people look for justification. They look for signals, and they try to justify their moral behavior. And what we see more often than not is that people don't even feel bad about this kind of behavior if they feel that they are doing the thing that other people do. So this is sort of like a peer effect. And if you think you are the only one who is missing out on that, you feel this need to comply and engage in these kinds of behavior as well.
Let me read a couple of comments. Mark, an email from Rob who says, why can't we just have two versions of each sport, one for the non-doping, clean, and one for all those who choose to dope? I can't imagine something like that, but it's an idea. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, bodybuilding has tried it, but logistically it's hard enough to put on one Summer Olympics every 4 years, so funding and putting on a dope-free Olympics along with a high-octane Olympics is just logistically, I don't see it happening.
And we have an email from Richard. Should we as a society sanction or tolerate performance-enhancing drugs? That's to you, Mark.
I mean, I think we already do for society at large as Americans, and our legislators have said, yes, it's okay to advertise drugs on television. We are, and New Zealand are the only countries in the world that have said that you can do that. So we've already sent a pretty strong message. But in sport, you look at baseball during the steroid era and after the strike in the early 90s, baseball was suffering and fans weren't returning because they were angry that this strike was between billionaires and millionaires. And then with steroids and ballplayers started swatting home runs like crazy. The ballparks were made smaller, and fans came back, and they knew they were doping. I mean, androstenedione, the drug that Mark McGwire was using, was available over-the-counter in health food stores, and fans didn't seem to care. It was good entertainment, and if they were doped, well, we might have said we were against doping, or actions suggested otherwise, that we really didn't care.
And we meaning the public. Go ahead, Oregon.
Yeah, and I mean, so a couple of years ago, following the doping cases in cycling, and German television declined to stream any of the main events really on public television, and so the big events were canceled too. So they took a stand and said, we are not going to be supporting these kind of events if we have to expect that this competition is rigged. And the fans reacted to that as well. So they put a lot of pressure on the press, a lot of pressure on the athletes. So they tried to change legislation. And try to change sort of the approach to that. And I believe the problem with having Olympic Games or any kind of competition where you would have to expect people to be doped, this will lead to a decreased interest in this kind of competition, because in the end, it's not only about winning the competition, but also feeling like you gave your best and somebody else gave his best or her best. And then really the better person came out as a winner, not the person who was having the most money to buy the best drugs available.
But you're saying for maybe not all the public, but for a lot of the public, if they feel cheated, they might not tune in or they might not go to a sporting event?
Absolutely. And I mean, and this will result in lower price money. This will result in – this is a high cost to the sports as well, right? If you have a declined interest in the sports, people are less inclined to buy fan shirts or any kind of fan articles. And this will ensure that sort of the cheating goes down as the interest goes down too.
But Mark, it sounds like you're saying people – they just want to see people performing at high levels and they don't care what they're taking.
Yeah, I mean, based on the National Football League and Major League Baseball, that wasn't the case at all. Fans may have said that players shouldn't be taking steroids and amphetamines, but they were still spending money on the games. So what people said and what they did was two different things. And, I mean, I think for fans, the way to understand this anti-doping struggle is it's really a collective enterprise. It's one thing to say, well, if only we get rid of these moral degenerates, pick out the Lance Armstrongs and the Ben Johnsons, then sport would be pure again. That's oversimplifying it, because it really is a collective endeavor. And I think the Russian doping system that was just exposed by WADA really illustrates that. And again, I think that IOC missed a great opportunity to solve and approach the problem at the structural level, saying nations and coaches and athletes are all going to be punished together. And when France banned drugs in 1965, that was their original approach too, because they felt that it was really addressed at cyclists, because they felt that cyclists were being exploited because the races were so hard. They had to turn to drugs to do their jobs. And so the law in France in 1965 really focused at the coaches and doctors who were administering the drugs. And it was an effort to protect the worker bicyclists.
The argument against collective punishment is that it ends up punishing, Mark, people who have never used a performance-enhancing drug.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the case. And although the World Anti-Doping Agency in its latest McLaren report said remarkably that the assumption of innocence should not apply to the Soviet Union to the Russian athletes, because it was a requirement to be on the Russian team that you had to take drugs. So, yeah, I mean, some clean athletes would suffer, but I think in the long run, it might have sent a stronger message. You know, there were athletes in South Africa who certainly didn't believe in apartheid, yet they weren't able to compete in the Olympics. And likewise, in 2012, the IOC told Saudi Arabia, we're going to ban you from the Olympics because you won't allow women on your Olympic team. And so they threw two token women in, and they have four this year.
Go ahead, Oregon.
Yeah, so and Russia is a very special case, and there's definitely some geopolitical substance there, because it's a smaller country, other than Russia, some smaller country would have been expelled from the competition in no time. But Russia has been such a powerful country in the past, and they're so important now that you know, they put a lot of political pressure on the situation. And I mean, the following delegations against Russia, the government said this is just a campaign by the West. They just try to put us down, and they also claim that it's the individual athletes that should be, you know, be punished, and it's not so much and blamed. It's not so much the state, but this McLaren report clearly states that it's more of a systemic problem in Russia, and it's really all of these different structures involved. It's not just the athletes, it's very much the government as well.
Phone number 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a couple of comments. I'm tired of all the finger-pointing, finger-waving shenanigans in the Olympics. It used to be a bastion of class in an otherwise ostentatious world, but now it's just ostentatiousness, self-aggrandizing show. A tweet from Pete, maybe they should just legalize all of it. Facebook comment from Deborah, I'm no advocate of doping, but does the line blur when things such as Michael Phelps cupping, golfers have LASIK surgery to better read the greens? And this cupping thing is such an interesting, when I saw Michael Phelps and some of the other swimmers with these strange little circles on their backs, I wasn't sure exactly what I was looking at. Mark, can you explain cupping to us, and then we'll get some callers in?
Well, as I understand it, it's a way of using a little rubber cup to suck the skin away from the muscle, and it draws blood to that area and supposedly helps with recovery from training.
Right. I mean, does that raise questions about whether that's some kind of a performance-enhancing procedure?
Well, I mean, that's really an issue, is what is performance enhancement is constantly being raised. In fact, in my book, I write about when in 1984, the U.S. cycling team was using blood doping, which wasn't a banned process at the time. And that's where you take your own blood out, you store it, and then you reintroduce it. And it helps you, for endurance athletes, to improve your performance. And if you look at the letters to the editor in Sports Illustrated following that, people said, well, if this is illegal, then maybe we should ban cyclists from training at altitude, because that has the same effect in terms of raising your red blood cell count. And so it is a constantly moving target, is what's banned and what's not, and you know, what technology is morally reprehensible and what is it acceptable is constantly changing.
Let me see what Brad from Bucks County has to say. Brad, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask your guests to comment on the Hungarian swimmer, Katinka Hosszú. There have been a lot of rumors that she's on something, but no one's able to. And she is threatening lawsuits, and she's actually going through lots of lawsuits back and forth. So would they like to comment about her?
Yeah, let's find out. And she's a Hungarian swimmer. Is that what you said, Brad?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm looking at you, Eugen, but just when there are allegations and then denials and more allegations, and we know that there are all sorts of ways to cheat the testing as well, where does it leave us?
Yeah. So,
for a swimmer like this?
Yeah. So I can't really speak to that specific case, but I want to raise awareness that we should be careful and just expecting everyone to dope just because they compete very well in the competition. Right? We should be aware that there are ways of circumventing the test and being able to, you know, show up negative in the test. But we should be careful in just expecting every kind of professional athlete to take anything just because we don't expect this, you know, an athlete from this nation to perform as well as we think they should. Right?
What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I can't comment on that particular case because I'm not really familiar with it. But you know, fans are, because they've been told for so long that athletes are clean, and again they keep getting busted. You know, fans are right to be suspicious.
Yeah, and that's of course has all sorts of reverberating effects. Well, again, it's interesting. You focus on what's described as both immoral and criminal behavior. Mark has talked a little bit about this, you know, this alleged or supposed purity of the games. Is there some intersection between immoral behavior and criminal behavior?
Well, I mean, so there's a blurred line between these things, right? And I would say criminal behavior, it becomes immoral behavior becomes criminal as soon as there are laws that you sort of that you know and you are aware of, or maybe even not, and you cross these lines, right? And immoral is more often than not, it's just something that I decide to do, which benefits myself and might be detrimental to somebody else, but it's just maybe me being antisocial or not kind, or maybe, you know, just taking away a chance from somebody, right? So that's. Yeah,
that's the connection there.
Yeah.
A question from Judy, Mark. I'm going to toss this to you. Why do they keep breaking world records if they're not doping? And you said, you know, you can't be suspicious of everybody. But what do you say to someone who asked that question?
Well, I think the way to look at it is doping is just one small element in a stack of performance enhancing methodologies that it can be. Better recovery, better, more sophisticated understanding of human physiology, other technologies such as when the swimmers are using the swimsuits, cycling technology is always increasing. So it's not just drugs that break world records. It's also a whole system of performance-enhancing medical techniques, and all those are increasing independent of drug use. So collectively, they're still pushing where we go with human performance.
Mark, are you watching the Olympics?
A little bit. I'm actually in Italy, so I haven't been watching it that much because it's on in the middle of the night.
But if you were in the U.S., would you be watching it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the way I look at sports like the Tour de France, I almost look at it as when I watch the Rolling Stones, I don't judge them because of Keith Richards' colorful drug background. I still can get an aesthetic pleasure out of that. And I kind of look at cycling the same way. Cyclists have doped from the 1870s when the sport started. The sport is still struggling to get this deep tradition out of its system. And if some of them are still doping, I don't think it makes the sport any less beautiful or fascinating to watch because they still are the greatest athletes. And drugs alone would not make me capable of racing in the Tour de France.
Anything you want to add? We're almost out of time here.
Yeah, I think we have this risk of keeping up the interest in these kind of sports. And if we allow doping to be part of the sports system, then we cannot distinguish anymore between the fair athletes who really dedicated their whole life to perform well and those who've been lucky enough to be part of a doping system that allowed them to compete. And I believe that sends the wrong signal to the young athletes, and that sends the wrong signal to the society.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Eugen Dement joining us here in our Philadelphia studio, a behavioral researcher at the University of Pennsylvania. Mark Johnson, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much. It's been great. The Olympics.
Absolutely. And enjoy Italy. Author of Spitting in the Soup, Inside the Dirty Game of Doping in Sport. I'm Marty Moscoen. That's it for the first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back.